If you don't question me, you won't feel obliged to deny it. Just accept what you do know anyway. That I know it. Taut like a string pulled by anger against the impertinence at one end, and by admiration for the frankness at the other, Reardon answered, I'll admit it, if you wish. What should it matter to me that you know it? That I know and care, Mr. Reardon. I'm the only man around you who does. Why should you care? And why should I need your help tonight? Because it's not easy to have to damn the man who meant most to you. I wouldn't damn you if you'd only stay away from me. Francisco's eyes widened a little, then he grinned and said, I was speaking of Mr. Daniger. For an instant Reardon looked as if he wanted to slap his own face. Then he laughed softly and said, All right. Sit down. He waited to see what advantage Francisco would take of it now, but Francisco obeyed him in silence, with a smile that had an oddly boyish quality, a look of triumph and gratitude together. I don't damn Ken Daniger, said Reardon. You don't. The two words seemed to fall with a singular emphasis. They were pronounced very quietly, almost cautiously, with no remnant of a smile on Francisco's face. No. I don't try to prescribe how much a man should have to bear. If he broke, it's not for me to judge him.
If he broke?
Well, didn't he? Francisco leaned back. His smile returned, but it was not a happy smile.
What will his disappearance do to you?
I will just have to work a little harder. Francisco looked at a steel bridge traced in black strokes against red steam beyond the window and said, pointing,
Every one of those girders has a limit to the load it can carry. What's yours?
Reardon laughed. Is that what you're afraid of? Is that why you came here? Were you afraid I'd break? Did you want to save me as Dagny Taggart wanted to save Ken Daniger? She tried to reach him in time, but couldn't.
She did. I didn't know it.
Miss Taggart and I disagree about many things. Don't worry. I'm not going to vanish. Let them all give up and stop working. I won't. I don't know my limit and don't care. All I have to know is that I can't be stopped.
Any man can be stopped, Mr. Reardon.
How?
It's only a matter of knowing man's motive power.
What is it?
You ought to know, Mr. Reardon. You're one of the last moral men left to the world.
Reardon chuckled in bitter amusement. I've been called just about everything but that. And you're wrong. You have no idea how wrong.
Are you sure?
I ought to know. Moral? What on earth made you say it? Francisco pointed to the mills beyond the window.
This.
For a long moment, Reardon looked at him without moving, then asked only, What do you mean?
If you want to see an abstract principle, such as moral action in material form, there it is. Look at it, Mr. Reardon. Every girder of it, every pipe, wire, and valve was put there by a choice in answer to the question, right or wrong. You had to choose right, and you had to choose the best within your knowledge, the best for your purpose, which was to make steel. And then move on and extend the knowledge and do better and still better with your purpose as your standard of value. You had to act on your own judgment. You had to have the capacity to judge, the courage to stand on the verdict of your mind, and the purest, the most ruthless consecration to the rule of doing right, of doing the best, the utmost best possible to you. Nothing could have made you act against your judgment, and you would have rejected as wrong, as evil, Any man who attempted to tell you that the best way to heat a furnace was to fill it with ice. Millions of men, an entire nation, were not able to deter you from producing Riordan metal, because you had the knowledge of its superlative value and the power which such knowledge gives. But what I wonder about, Mr. Riordan, is why you live by one code of principles when you deal with nature, and by another when you deal with men. Riordan's eyes were fixed on him so intently that the question came slowly, as if the effort to pronounce it were a distraction. What do you mean? Why don't you hold to the purpose of your life as clearly and rigidly as you hold to the purpose of your mills? What do you mean? You have judged every brick within this place by its value to the goal of making steel. Have you been as strict about the goal which your work and your steel are serving? What do you wish to achieve by giving your life to the making of steel? By what standard of value do you judge your days? For instance, why did you spend 10 years of exacting effort to produce Riordan metal? Riordan looked away, the slight slumping movement of his shoulders like a sigh of release and disappointment. If you have to ask that, then you wouldn't understand. If I told you that I understand it, but you don't, would you throw me out of here? I should have thrown you out of here anyway. So go ahead. Tell me what you mean. Are you proud of the rail of the Jungalt line? Yes. Why? Because it's the best rail ever made. Why did you make it? In order to make money. There were many easier ways to make money. Why did you choose the hardest? You said it in your speech at Taggart's wedding. In order to exchange my best effort for the best effort of others. If that was your purpose, have you achieved it? A bead of time vanished in a heavy drop of silence. No, said Riordan. Have you made any money? No. When you strain your energy to its utmost in order to produce the best, do you expect to be rewarded for it or punished? Riordan did not answer. By every standard of decency, of honor, of justice known to you, are you convinced that you should have been rewarded for it? Yes, said Riordan, his voice low. Then if you were punished instead, what sort of code have you accepted? Riordan did not answer. It is generally assumed, said Francisco, that living in a human society makes one's life much easier and safer than if one were left alone to struggle against nature on a desert island. Now, wherever there is a man who needs or uses metal in any way, Riordan metal has made his life easier for him. Has it made yours easier for you? No, said Riordan, his voice low. Has it left your life as it was before you produced the metal? No, said Riordan, the word breaking off as if he had cut short the thought that followed. Francisco's voice lashed at him suddenly, as a command. Say it. It has made it harder, said Riordan tonelessly. When you felt proud of the rail of the Jungalt line, said Francisco, the measured rhythm of his voice giving a ruthless clarity to his words, what sort of men did you think of? Did you want to see that line used by your equals, by giants of productive energy such as Ellis Wyatt, whom it would help to reach higher and still higher achievements of their own? Yes, said Riordan eagerly. Did you want to see it used by men who could not equal the power of your mind, but who would equal your moral integrity? Men such as Eddie Willers, who could never invent your metal, but who would do their best, work as hard as you did, live by their own effort, and, riding on your rail, give a moment's silent thanks to the man who gave them more than they could give him? Yes, said Riordan gently. Did you want to see it used by whining rotters who never rouse themselves to any effort, who do not possess the ability of a filing clerk, but demand the income of a company president, who drift from failure to failure and expect you to pay their bills, who hold their wishing as an equivalent of your work and their need as a higher claim to reward than your effort, who demand that you serve them, who demand that it be the aim of your life to serve them, who demand that your strength be the voiceless, rightless, unpaid, unrewarded slave of their impotence, who proclaim that you are born to serfdom by reason of your genius, while they are born to rule by the grace of incompetence, that yours is only to give, but theirs only to take, that yours is to produce, but theirs to consume, that you are not to be paid, neither in matter nor in spirit, neither by wealth nor by recognition nor by respect nor by gratitude, so that they would ride on your rail and sneer at you and curse you, since they owe you nothing, not even the effort of taking off their hats which you paid for. Would this be what you wanted? Would you feel proud of it?
I'd blast that rail first, said Reardon, his lips white.
Then why don't you do it, Mr. Reardon? Of the three kinds of men I described, which men are being destroyed, and which are using your line today?
They heard the distant metal heartbeats of the mills through the long thread of silence.
What I described last, said Francisco, is any man who proclaims his right to a single penny of another man's effort.
Reardon did not answer. He was looking at the reflection of a neon sign on dark windows in the distance.
You take pride in setting no limit to your endurance, Mr. Reardon, because you think that you are doing right. What if you aren't? What if you're placing your virtue in the service of evil and letting it become a tool for the destruction of everything you love, respect, and admire? Why don't you uphold your own code of values among men as you do among iron smelters? You who won't allow 1% of impurity into an alloy of metal. What have you allowed into your moral code?
Reardon sat very still. The words in his mind were like the beat of steps down the trail he had been seeking. The words were the sanction of the victim.
You who would not submit to the hardships of nature, but set out to conquer it and placed it in the service of your joy and your comfort. To what have you submitted at the hands of men? You who know from your work that one bears punishment only for being wrong, what have you been willing to bear, and for what reason? All your life you have heard yourself denounced, not for your faults, but for your greatest virtues. You have been hated, not for your mistakes, but for your achievements. You have been scorned for all those qualities of character which are your highest pride. You have been called selfish for the courage of acting on your own judgment and bearing sole responsibility for your own life. You have been called arrogant for your independent mind. You have been called cruel for your unyielding integrity. You have been called antisocial for the vision that made you venture upon undiscovered roads. You have been called ruthless for the strength and self-discipline of your drive to your purpose. You have been called greedy for the magnificence of your power to create wealth. You, who've expended an inconceivable flow of energy, have been called a parasite. You, who've created abundance where there had been nothing but wastelands and helpless, starving men before you, have been called a robber. You, who've kept them all alive, have been called an exploiter. You, the purest and most moral man among them, have been sneered at as a vulgar materialist. Have you stopped to ask them, by what right? By what code? By what standard? No. You have borne it all and kept silent. You bowed to their code, and you never upheld your own. You knew what exacting morality was needed to produce a single metal nail, but you let them brand you as immoral. You knew that man needs the strictest code of values to deal with nature, but you thought that you needed no such code to deal with men. You left the deadliest weapon in the hands of your enemies, a weapon you never suspected or understood. Their moral code is their weapon. Ask yourself how deeply and in how many terrible ways you have accepted it. Ask yourself what it is that a code of moral values does to a man's life, and why he can't exist without it, and what happens to him if he accepts the wrong standard, by which the evil is the good. Shall I tell you why you're drawn to me, even though you think you ought to damn me? It's because I'm the first man who has given you what the whole world owes you, and what you should have demanded of all men before you dealt with them. A moral sanction. Reardon whirled to him, then remained still, with a stillness like a gasp. Francisco leaned forward, as if he were reaching the landing of a dangerous flight, and his eyes were steady, but their glance seemed to tremble with intensity. You're guilty of a great sin, Mr. Reardon. Much guiltier than they tell you, but not in the way they preach. The worst guilt is to accept an undeserved guilt. And that is what you have been doing all your life. You have been paying blackmail, not for your vices, but for your virtues. You have been willing to carry the load of an unearned punishment, and to let it grow the heavier, the greater the virtues you practiced. But your virtues were those which kept men alive. Your own moral code, the one you lived by but never stated, acknowledged, or defended, was the code that preserves man's existence. If you were punished for it, what was the nature of those who punished you? Yours was the code of life. What, then, is theirs? What standard of value lies at its root? What is its ultimate purpose? Do you think that what you're facing is merely a conspiracy to seize your wealth? You, who know the source of wealth, should know it's much more and much worse than that. Did you ask me to name man's motive power? Man's motive power is his moral code. Ask yourself where their code is leading you and what it offers you as your final goal. A viler evil than to murder a man is to sell him suicide as an act of virtue. A viler evil than to throw a man into a sacrificial furnace is to demand that he leap in of his own will and that he build the furnace besides. By their own statement, it is they who need you and have nothing to offer you in return. By their own statement, you must support them because they cannot survive without you. Consider the obscenity of offering their impotence and their need of you, as a justification for your torture. Are you willing to accept it? Do you care to purchase, at the price of your great endurance, at the price of your agony, the satisfaction of the needs of your own destroyers? No. Mr. Reardon, said Francisco, his voice solemnly calm, if you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders. What would you tell him to do?
I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him?
To shrug. The clatter of the metal came in a flow of irregular sounds without discernible rhythm, not like the action of a mechanism, but as if some conscious impulse were behind every sudden tearing rise that went up and crashed, scattering into the faint moan of gears. The glass of the windows tinkled once in a while. Francisco's eyes were watching Reardon as if he were examining the course of bullets on a battered target. The course was hard to trace. The gaunt figure on the edge of the desk was erect. The cold blue eyes showed nothing but the intensity of a glance fixed upon a great distance. Only the inflexible mouth betrayed a line drawn by pain.
"Go on," said Reardon with effort. "Continue. You haven't finished, have you?" "I have barely begun."
Francisco's voice was hard.
"What are you driving at?"
"You'll know it before I'm through. But first I want you to answer a question. If you understand the nature of your burden, how can you—"
The scream of an alarm siren shattered the space beyond the window and shot like a rocket in a long, thin line to the sky. It held for an instant, then fell, then went on in rising, falling spirals of sound, as if fighting for breath against terror to scream louder. It was the shriek of agony, the call for help, the voice of the mills as of a wounded body crying to hold its soul. Reardon thought that he leaped for the door the instant the scream hit his consciousness, but he saw that he was an instant late, because Francisco had preceded him. Flung by the blast of the same response as his own, Francisco was flying down the hall, pressing the button of the elevator and, not waiting, racing on down the stairs. Reardon followed him, and, watching the dial of the elevator on the stair landings, they met it halfway down the height of the building. Before the steel cage had ceased trembling at the sill of the ground floor, Francisco was out, racing to meet the sound of the call for help. Reardon had thought himself a good runner, but he could not keep up with the swift figure streaking off through stretches of red glare and darkness, the figure of a useless playboy he had hated himself for admiring. The stream, gushing from a hole low on the side of a blast furnace, did not have the red glow of fire, but the white radiance of sunlight. It poured along the ground, branching off at random in sudden streaks. It cut through a dank fog of steam with a bright suggestion of morning. It was liquid iron, and what the scream of the alarm proclaimed was a breakout. The charge of the furnace had been hung up, and, breaking, had blown the tap hole open. The furnace foreman lay knocked unconscious. The white flow spurted, slowly tearing the hole wider, and men were struggling with sand, hose, and fire clay to stop the glowing streaks that spread in a heavy, gliding motion, eating everything on their way into jets of acrid smoke. In the few moments which Reardon needed to grasp the sight and nature of the disaster, he saw a man's figure rising suddenly at the foot of the furnace, a figure outlined by the red glare almost as if it stood in the path of the torrent. He saw the swing of a white shirt-sleeved arm that rose and flung a black object into the source of the spurting metal. It was Francisco D'Anconia, and his action belonged to an art which Reardon had not believed any man to be trained to perform any longer. Years before, Reardon had worked in an obscure steel plant in Minnesota, where it had been his job, after a blast furnace was tapped, to close the hole by hand, by throwing bullets of fire clay to dam the flow of the metal. It was a dangerous job that had taken many lives. It had been abolished years earlier by the invention of the hydraulic gun. But there had been struggling, failing mills which, on their way down, had attempted to use the outworn equipment and methods of a distant past. Reardon had done the job, but in the years since, he had met no other man able to do it. In the midst of shooting jets of live steam, in the face of a crumbling blast furnace, he was now seeing the tall, slim figure of the playboy performing the task with the skill of an expert. It took an instant for Reardon to tear off his coat, seize a pair of goggles from the first man in sight, and join Francisco at the mouth of the furnace. There was no time to speak, to feel, or to wonder. Francisco glanced at him once, and what Reardon saw was a smudged face,
black goggles, and a wide grin. They stood on a slippery bank of baked mud at the edge of the white stream, with the raging hole under their feet, flinging clay into the glare where the twisting tongues that looked like gas were boiling metal. Reardon's consciousness became a progression of bending, raising the weight, aiming and sending it down, and before it had reached its unseen destination, bending for the next one again, a consciousness drawn tight upon watching the aim of his arm to save the furnace, and the precarious posture of his feet to save himself. He was aware of nothing else, except that the sum of it was the exultant feeling of action, of his own capacity, of his body's precision, of its response to his will. And with no time to know it, but knowing it, seizing it with his senses past the censorship of his mind, he was seeing a black silhouette with red rays shooting from behind its shoulders, its elbows, its angular curves, the red rays circling through steam like the long needles of spotlights, following the movements of a swift, expert, confident being whom he had never seen before except in evening clothes, under the lights of ballrooms. There was no time to form words, to think, to explain, but he knew that this was the real Francisco d'Anconia. This was what he had seen from the first and loved. The word did not shock him, because there was no word in his mind. There was only a joyous feeling that seemed like a flow of energy added to his own. To the rhythm of his body, with the scorching heat on his face and the winter night on his shoulder blades, he was seeing suddenly that this was the simple essence of his universe. The instantaneous refusal to submit to disaster, the irresistible drive to fight it, the triumphant feeling of his own ability to win. He was certain that Francisco felt it too, that he had been moved by the same impulse, that it was right to feel it, right for both of them to be what they were. He caught glimpses of a sweat-streaked face intent upon action, and it was the most joyous face he had ever seen. The furnace stood above them, a black bulk wrapped in coils of tubes and steam. She seemed to pant, shooting red gasps that hung on the air above the mills, and they fought not to let her bleed to death. Sparks hung about their feet and burst in sudden sheafs out of the metal, dying unnoticed against their clothes, against the skin of their hands. The stream was coming slower, in broken spurts through the dam rising beyond their sight. It happened so fast that Reardon knew it fully only after it was over. He knew that there were two moments. The first was when he saw the violent swing of Francisco's body in a forward thrust that sent the bullet to continue the line in space. Then he saw the sudden, unrhythmic jerk backward that did not succeed, the convulsive beating against a forward pull, the extended arms of the silhouette losing its balance. He thought that a leap across the distance between them on the slippery, crumbling ridge would mean the death of both of them. And the second moment was when he landed at Francisco's side, held him in his arms, hung swaying together between space and ridge, over the white pit, then gained his footing and pulled him back, and for an instant still held the length of Francisco's body against the length of his own, as he would have held the body of an only son. His love, his terror, his relief were in a single sentence. "Be careful, you goddamn fool!" Francisco reached for a chunk of clay and went on. When the job was done and the gap was closed, Reardon noticed that there was a twisting pain in the muscles of his arms and legs, that his body had no strength left to move, yet that he felt as if he were entering his office in the morning, eager for 10 new problems to solve. He looked at Francisco and noticed for the first time that their clothes had black ringed holes, that their hands were bleeding, that there was a patch of skin torn on Francisco's temple and a red thread winding down his cheekbone. Francisco pushed the goggles back off his eyes and grinned at him. It was a smile of mourning. A young man with a look of chronic hurt and impertinence together rushed up to him, crying, "I couldn't help it, Mr. Reardon," and launched into a speech of explanation. Reardon turned his back on him without a word. It was the assistant in charge of the pressure gauge of the furnace, a young man out of college. Somewhere on the outer edge of Reardon's consciousness,
There was the thought that accidents of this nature were happening more frequently now, caused by the kind of ore he was using, but he had to use whatever ore he could find. There was the thought that his old workers had always been able to avert disaster. Any of them would have seen the indications of a hang-up and known how to prevent it. But there were not many of them left, and he had to employ whatever men he could find. Through the swirling coils of steam around him, he observed that it was the older men who had rushed from all over the mills to fight the breakout and now stood in line, being given first aid by the medical staff. He wondered what was happening to the young men of the country. But the wonder was swallowed by the sight of the college boy's face, which he could not bear to see, by a wave of contempt, by the wordless thought that if this was the enemy, there was nothing to fear. All these things came to him and vanished in the outer darkness. The sight blotting them out was Francisco D'Anconia. He saw Francisco giving orders to the men around him. They did not know who he was or where he came from, but they listened. They knew he was a man who knew his job. Francisco broke off in the middle of a sentence, seeing Reardon approach and listen, and said, laughing, "Oh, I beg your pardon." Reardon said, "Go right ahead. It's all correct so far." They said nothing to each other when they walked together through the darkness on their way back to the office. Reardon felt an exultant laughter swelling within him. He felt that he wanted, in his turn, to wink at Francisco like a fellow conspirator who had learned a secret Francisco would not acknowledge. He glanced at his face once in a while, but Francisco would not look at him. After a while, Francisco said, "You saved my life." The thank you was in the way he said it. Reardon chuckled. "You saved my furnace." They went on in silence. Reardon felt himself growing lighter with every step. Raising his face to the cold air, he saw the peaceful darkness of the sky and a single star above a smokestack with the vertical lettering Reardon Steel. He felt how glad he was to be alive. He did not expect the change he saw in Francisco's face when he looked at it in the light of his office. The things he had seen by the glare of the furnace were gone. He had expected a look of triumph, of mockery at all the insults Francisco had heard from him, a look demanding the apology he was joyously eager to offer. Instead, he saw a face made lifeless by an odd dejection. "Are you hurt?"
"No. No, not at all."
"Come here," ordered Reardon, opening the door of his bathroom.
"Look at yourself."
"Never mind. You come here." For the first time, Reardon felt that he was the older man. He felt the pleasure of taking Francisco in charge. He felt a confident, amused, paternal protectiveness. He washed the grime off Francisco's face. He put disinfectants and adhesive bandages on his temple, his hands, his scorched elbows. Francisco obeyed him in silence. Reardon asked, in the tone of the most eloquent salute he could offer, "Where did you learn to work like that?" Francisco shrugged.
"I was brought up around smelters of every kind," he answered indifferently.
Reardon could not decipher the expression of his face. It was only a look of peculiar stillness, as if his eyes were fixed on some secret vision of his own that drew his mouth into a line of desolate, bitter, hurting self-mockery. They did not speak until they were back in the office.
"You know," said Reardon, "everything you said here was true. But that was only part of the story. The other part is what we've done tonight. Don't you see? We're able to act. They're not. So it's we who will win in the long run, no matter what they do to us."
Francisco did not answer.
"Listen," said Reardon, "I know what's been the trouble with you. You've never cared to do a real day's work in your life. I thought you were conceited enough, but I see that you have no idea of what you've got in you. Forget that fortune of yours for a while and come to work for me. I'll start you as furnace foreman any time. You don't know what it will do for you.
In a few years, you'll be ready to appreciate and to run Danconia Copper. He expected a burst of laughter, and he was prepared to argue. Instead, he saw Francisco shaking his head slowly, as if he could not trust his voice, as if he feared that were he to speak, he would accept. In a moment, he said,
Mr. Reardon, I think I would give the rest of my life for 1 year as your furnace foreman. But I can't.
Why not?
Don't ask me. It's a personal matter.
The vision of Francisco in Reardon's mind, which he had resented and found irresistibly attractive, had been the figure of a man radiantly incapable of suffering. What he saw now in Francisco's eyes was the look of a quiet, tightly controlled, patiently borne torture. Francisco reached silently for his overcoat. "You're not leaving, are you?" asked Reardon.
"Yes."
"Aren't you going to finish what you had to tell me?"
"Not tonight."
"You wanted me to answer a question." "What was it?"
Francisco shook his head.
"You started asking me, how can I
what?"
Francisco's smile was like a moan of pain, the only moan he would permit himself.
"I won't ask it, Mr. Reardon. I know it."
Chapter 4. The Sanction of the Victim. The roast turkey had cost $30. The champagne had cost $25. The lace tablecloth, a cobweb of grapes and vine leaves iridescent in the candlelight, had cost $2,000. The dinner service, with an artist's design burned in blue and gold into a translucent white china, had cost $2,500. The silverware, which bore the initials L.R. in empire wreaths of laurels, had cost $3,000. But it was held to be unspiritual to think of money and of what that money represented. A peasant's wooden shoe, gilded, stood in the center of the table, filled with marigolds, grapes, and carrots. The candles were stuck into pumpkins that were cut as open-mouthed faces, drooling raisins, nuts, and candy upon the tablecloth. It was Thanksgiving dinner, and the three who faced Reardon about the table were his wife, his mother, and his brother.
"This is the night to thank the Lord for our blessings," said Reardon's mother. "God has been kind to us. There are people all over the country who haven't got any food in the house tonight, and some that haven't even got a house, and more of them going jobless every day. Gives me the creeps to look around in the city. Why, only last week, who do you suppose I ran into but Lucy Judson? Henry, do you remember Lucy Judson? Used to live next door to us up in Minnesota when you were 10, 12 years old. Had a boy about your age. I lost track of Lucy when they moved to New York. Must have been all of 20 years ago. Well, it gave me the creeps to see what she's come to. Just a toothless old hag wrapped in a man's overcoat, panhandling on a street corner. And I thought, that could have been me, but for the grace of God."
"Well, if thanks are in order," said Lillian gaily, "I think that we shouldn't forget Gertrude, the new cook. She's an artist."
"Me, I'm just going to be old-fashioned," said Philip. "I'm just going to thank the sweetest mother in the world."
"Well, for the matter of that," said Reardon's mother, "we ought to thank Lillian for this dinner and for all the trouble she took to make it so pretty. She spent hours fixing the table. It's real quaint and different."
"It's the wooden shoe that does it," said Philip, bending his head sideways to study it in a manner of critical appreciation. "That's the real touch. Anybody can have candles, silverware, and junk. That doesn't take anything but money. But this shoe, that took thought."
Reardon said nothing. The candlelight moved over his motionless face as over a portrait. The portrait bore an expression of impersonal courtesy.
"You haven't touched your wine," said his mother, looking at him. "What I think is you ought to drink a toast in gratitude to the people of this country who have given you so much."
"Henry is not in the mood for it, mother," said Lillian. "I'm afraid Thanksgiving is a holiday only for those who have a clear conscience."
She raised her wine glass, but stopped it halfway to her lips and asked,
You're not going to make some sort of stand at your trial tomorrow, are you, Henry?
I am.
She put the glass down. What are you going to do?
You'll see it tomorrow.
You don't really imagine that you can get away with it.
I don't know what you have in mind as the object I'm to get away with.
Do you realize that the charge against you is extremely serious?
I do.
You've admitted that you sold the medal to Ken Daniger.
I have.
They might send you to jail for 10 years.
I don't think they will, but it's possible.
Have you been reading the newspapers, Henry? Asked Philip, with an odd kind of smile.
No.
Oh, you should.
Should I? Why?
You ought to see the names they call you.
That's interesting, said Reardon. He said it about the fact that Philip's smile was one of pleasure.
I don't understand it, said his mother. Jail. Did you say jail, Lillian? Henry, are you going to be sent to jail?
I might be.
But that's ridiculous. Do something about it.
What?
I don't know. I don't understand any of it. Respectable people don't go to jail. Do something. You've always known what to do about business.
Not this kind of business.
I don't believe it. Her voice had the tone of a frightened, spoiled child. You're saying it just to be mean.
He's playing the hero, Mother, said Lillian.
She smiled coldly, turning to Reardon.
Don't you think that your attitude is perfectly futile?
No.
You know that cases of this kind are not intended ever to come to trial. There are ways to avoid it, to get things settled amicably, if one knows the right people.
I don't know the right people.
Look at Orrin Boyle.
He's done much more and much worse than your little fling at the black market, but he's smart enough to keep himself out of courtrooms. Then I'm not smart enough.
Don't you think it's time you made an effort to adjust yourself to the conditions of our age?
No.
Well, then I don't see how you can pretend that you're some sort of victim. If you go to jail, it will be your own fault.
What pretense are you talking about, Lillian?
Oh, I know that you think you're fighting for some sort of principle, but actually it's only a matter of your incredible conceit. You're doing it for no better reason than because you think you're right.
Do you think they're right?
She shrugged. That's the conceit I'm talking about. The idea that it matters who's right or wrong. It's the most insufferable form of vanity, this insistence on always doing right. How do you know what's right? How can anyone ever know it? It's nothing but a delusion to flatter your own ego and to hurt other people by flaunting your superiority over them.
He was looking at her with attentive interest. Why should it hurt other people, if it's nothing but a delusion?
Is it necessary for me to point out that in your case it's nothing but hypocrisy? That is why I find your attitude preposterous. Questions of right have no bearing on human existence, and you're certainly nothing but human. Aren't you, Henry? You're no better than any of the men you're going to face tomorrow. I think you should remember that it's not for you to make a stand on any sort of principle. Maybe you're a victim in this particular mess. Maybe they're pulling a rotten trick on you, but what of it? They're doing it because they're weak. They couldn't resist the temptation to grab your metal and to muscle in on your profits, because they had no other way of ever getting rich. Why should you blame them? It's only a question of different strains, but it's the same shoddy human fabric that gives way just as quickly. You wouldn't be tempted by money because it's so easy for you to make it. But you wouldn't withstand other pressures, and you'd fall just as ignominiously.
Wouldn't you?
so you have no right to any righteous indignation against them. You have no moral superiority to assert or to defend. And if you haven't, then what is the point of fighting a battle that you can't win? I suppose that one might find some satisfaction in being a martyr, if one is above reproach. But you, who are you to cast the first stone? She paused to observe the effect. There was none, except that his look of attentive interest seemed intensified. He listened as if he were held by some impersonal scientific curiosity. It was not the response she had expected. "I believe you understand me," she said. "No," he answered quietly, "I don't." "I think you should abandon the illusion of your own perfection, which you know full well to be an illusion. I think you should learn to get along with other people. The day of the hero is past. This is the day of humanity, in a much deeper sense than you imagine. Human beings are no longer expected to be saints, nor to be punished for their sins. Nobody is right or wrong. We're all in it together. We're all human. And the human is the imperfect. You'll gain nothing tomorrow by proving that they're wrong. You want to give in with good grace, simply because it's the practical thing to do. You ought to keep silent precisely because they're wrong. They'll appreciate it. Make concessions for others, and they'll make concessions for you. Live and let live. Give and take. Give in and take in. That's the policy of our age, and it's time you accepted it. Don't tell me you're too good for it. You know that you're not. You know that I know it." The look of his eyes, held raptly still upon some point in space, was not in answer to her words. It was in answer to a man's voice saying to him, "Do you think that what you're facing is merely a conspiracy to seize your wealth? You, who know the source of wealth, should know it's much more and much worse than that." He turned to look at Lillian. He was seeing the full extent of her failure, in the immensity of his own indifference. The droning stream of her insults was like the sound of a distant riveting machine, a long, impotent pressure that reached nothing within him. He had heard her studied reminders of his guilt on every evening he had spent at home in the past 3 months, but guilt had been the one emotion he had found himself unable to feel. The punishment she had wanted to inflict on him was the torture of shame. What she had inflicted was the torture of boredom. He remembered his brief glimpse, on that morning in the Wayne Falkland Hotel, of a flaw in her scheme of punishment, which he had not examined. Now he stated it to himself for the first time. She wanted to force upon him the suffering of dishonor, but his own sense of honor was her only weapon of enforcement. She wanted to wrest from him an acknowledgment of his moral depravity, but only his own moral rectitude could attach significance to such a verdict. She wanted to injure him by her contempt, but he could not be injured unless he respected her judgment. She wanted to punish him for the pain he had caused her, and she held her pain as a gun aimed at him, as if she wished to extort his agony at the point of his pity. But her only tool was his own benevolence, his concern for her, his compassion. Her only power was the power of his own virtues. What if he chose to withdraw it? An issue of guilt, he thought, had to rest on his own acceptance of the code of justice that pronounced him guilty. He did not accept it. He never had. His virtues, all the virtues she needed to achieve his punishment, came from another code and lived by another standard. He felt no guilt, no shame, no regret, no dishonor. He felt no concern for any verdict she chose to pass upon him.
He had lost respect for her judgment long ago, and the soul chain still holding him was only a last remnant of pity. But what was the code on which she acted? What sort of code permitted the concept of a punishment that required the victim's own virtue as the fuel to make it work? A code, he thought, which would destroy only those who tried to observe it. A punishment from which only the honest would suffer, while the dishonest would escape unhurt. Could one conceive of an infamy lower than to equate virtue with pain? To make virtue, not vice, the source and motive power of suffering. If he were the kind of rotter she was struggling to make him believe he was, then no issue of his honor and his moral worth would matter to him. If he wasn't, then what was the nature of her attempt? To count upon his virtue and use it as an instrument of torture. To practice blackmail with the victim's generosity as sole means of extortion, to accept the gift of a man's goodwill and turn it into a tool for the giver's destruction. He sat very still, contemplating the formula of so monstrous an evil that he was able to name it, but not to believe it possible. He sat very still, held by the hammering of a single question. Did Lillian know the exact nature of her scheme? Was it a conscious policy devised with full awareness of its meaning? He shuddered. He did not hate her enough to believe it. He looked at her. She was absorbed at the moment in the task of cutting a plum pudding that stood as a mount of blue flame on a silver platter before her, its glow dancing over her face and her laughing mouth. She was plunging a silver knife into the flame with a practiced, graceful curve of her arm. She had metallic leaves in the red, gold, and brown colors of autumn scattered over one shoulder of her black velvet gown. They glittered in the candlelight. He could not get rid of the impression, which he had kept receiving and rejecting for 3 months, that her vengeance was not a form of despair, as he had supposed. The impression, which he regarded as inconceivable, that she was enjoying it. He could find no trace of pain in her manner. She had an air of confidence new to her. She seemed to be at home in her house for the first time. Even though everything within the house was of her own choice and taste, she had always seemed to act as the bright, efficient, resentful manager of a high-class hotel, who keeps smiling in bitter amusement at her position of inferiority to the owners. The amusement remained, but the bitterness was gone. She had not gained weight, but her features had lost their delicate sharpness in a blurring, softening look of satisfaction. Even her voice sounded as if it had grown plump. He did not hear what she was saying. She was laughing in the last flicker of the blue flames, while he sat weighing the question, did she know? He felt certain that he had discovered a secret much greater than the problem of his marriage, that he had grasped the formula of a policy practiced more widely throughout the world than he dared to contemplate at the moment. But to convict a human being of that practice was a verdict of irrevocable damnation, and he knew that he would not believe it of anyone, so long as the possibility of a doubt remained. No, he thought, looking at Lillian with the last effort of his generosity. He would not believe it of her. In the name of whatever grace and pride she possessed, in the name of such moments when he had seen a smile of joy on her face, the smile of a living being, in the name of the brief shadow of love he had once felt for her, he would not pronounce upon her a verdict of total evil. The butler slipped a plate of plum pudding in front of him, and he heard Lillian's voice. "Where have you been for the last 5 minutes, Henry? Or is it for the last century? You haven't answered me. You haven't heard a word I said." "I heard it," he answered quietly. "I don't know what you're trying to accomplish."
"What a question," said his mother. "Isn't that just like a man? She's trying to save you from going to jail. That's what she's trying to accomplish."
That could be true, he thought. Perhaps, by the reasoning of some crude, childish cowardice, the motive of their malice was a desire to protect him, to break him down into the safety of a compromise. It's possible, he thought, but knew that he did not believe it. You've always been unpopular, said Lillian, and it's more than a matter of any one particular issue. It's that unyielding, intractable attitude of yours. The men who are going to try you know what you're thinking. That's why they'll crack down on you while they'd let another man off.
Why, no. I don't think they know what I'm thinking. That's what I have to let them know tomorrow.
Unless you show them that you're willing to give in and cooperate, you won't have a chance. You've been too hard to deal with.
No, I've been too easy.
But if they put you in jail, said his mother, what's going to happen to your family? Have you thought of that?
No, I haven't.
Have you thought of the disgrace you'll bring upon us?
Mother, do you understand the issue in this case?
No, I don't, and I don't want to understand. It's all dirty business and dirty politics. All business is just dirty politics, and all politics is just dirty business. I never did want to understand any of it. I don't care who's right or wrong, but what I think a man ought to think of first is his family. Don't you know what this will do to us?
No, Mother. I don't know or care. His mother looked at him aghast.
Well, I think you have a very provincial attitude, all of you, said Philip suddenly. Nobody here seems to be concerned with the wider social aspects of the case. I don't agree with you, Lillian. I don't see why you say that they're pulling some sort of rotten trick on Henry and that he's in the right. I think he's guilty as hell. Mother, I can explain the issue to you very simply. There's nothing unusual about it. The courts are full of cases of this kind. Businessmen are taking advantage of the national emergency in order to make money. They break the regulations which protect the common welfare of all for the sake of their own personal gain. They're profiteers of the black market who grow rich by defrauding the poor of their rightful share at a time of desperate shortage. They pursue a ruthless, grasping, grabbing antisocial policy based on nothing but plain, selfish greed. It's no use pretending about it. We all know it. And I think it's contemptible. He spoke in a careless, offhand manner, as if explaining the obvious to a group of adolescents. His tone conveyed the assurance of a man who knows that the moral ground of his stand is not open to question. Reardon sat looking at him, as if studying an object seen for the first time. Somewhere deep in Reardon's mind, as a steady, gentle, inexorable beat, was a man's voice saying, "By what right? By what code? By what standard?" "Philip," he said, not raising his voice, "say any of that again, and you will find yourself out in the street, right now, with the suit you've got on your back, with whatever change you've got in your pocket, and with nothing else." He heard no answer, no sound, no movement. He noted that the stillness of the three before him had no element of astonishment. The look of shock on their faces was not the shock of people at the sudden explosion of a bomb, but the shock of people who had known that they were playing with a lighted fuse. There were no outcries, no protests, no questions. They knew that he meant it, and they knew everything it meant. A dim, sickening feeling told him that they had known it long before he did.
You wouldn't throw your own brother out on the street, would you? His mother said at last.
It was not a demand, but a plea.
I would.
But he's your brother. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
No.
Maybe he goes a bit too far at times, but it's just loose talk. It's just that modern jabber. He doesn't know what he's saying.
Then let him learn.
Don't be hard on him. He's younger than you and weaker. Henry, don't look at me that way. I've never seen you look like that.
You shouldn't frighten him. You know that he needs you.
Does he know it?
You can't be hard on a man who needs you. It will prey on your conscience for the rest of your life.
It won't.
You've got to be kind, Henry.
I'm not.
You've got to have some pity.
I haven't.
A good man knows how to forgive.
I don't.
You wouldn't want me to think that you're selfish.
I am.
Philip's eyes were darting from one to the other. He looked like a man who had felt certain that he stood on solid granite, and had suddenly discovered that it was thin ice, now cracking open all around him.
But I...
he tried, and stopped. His voice sounded like steps testing the ice.
But don't I have any freedom of speech?
In your own house, not in mine.
Don't I have a right to my own ideas?
At your own expense, not at mine.
Don't you tolerate any differences of opinion?
Not when I'm paying the bills.
Isn't there anything involved but money?
Yes. The fact that it's my money.
Don't you want to consider any high...
He was going to say higher, but changed his mind.
Any other aspects?
No.
But I'm not your slave.
Am I yours?
I don't know what you...
He stopped. He knew what was meant.
No, said Reardon, you're not my slave. You're free to walk out of here any time you choose.
I'm not speaking of that.
I am.
I don't understand it.
Don't you?
You've always known my political views. You've never objected before.
That's true, said Reardon gravely. Perhaps I owe you an explanation if I have misled you. I've tried never to remind you that you're living on my charity. I thought that it was your place to remember it. I thought that any human being who accepts the help of another knows that goodwill is the giver's only motive, and that goodwill is the payment he owes in return. But I see that I was wrong. You were getting your food unearned, and you concluded that affection did not have to be earned either. You concluded that I was the safest person in the world for you to spit on, precisely because I held you by the throat. You concluded that I wouldn't want to remind you of it, and that I would be tied by the fear of hurting your feelings. All right. Let's get it straight. You're an object of charity who's exhausted his credit long ago. Whatever affection I might have felt for you once is gone. I haven't the slightest interest in you, your fate, or your future. I haven't any reason whatever for wishing to feed you. If you leave my house, it won't make any difference to me whether you starve or not. Now that is your position here, and I will expect you to remember it if you wish to stay. If not, then get out. But for the movement of drawing his head a little into his shoulders, Philip showed no reaction.
Don't imagine that I enjoy living here, he said. His voice was lifeless and shrill. If you think I'm happy, you're mistaken. I'd give anything to get away.
The words pertained to defiance, but the voice had a curiously cautious quality.
If that is how you feel about it, it would be best for me to leave.
The words were a statement, but the voice put a question mark at the end of it and waited. There was no answer.
You needn't worry about my future. I don't have to ask favors of anybody. I can take care of myself, all right.
The words were addressed to Reardon, but the eyes were looking at his mother. She did not speak. She was afraid to move.
I've always wanted to be on my own. I've always wanted to live in New York near all my friends.
The voice slowed down and added in an impersonal, reflective manner, as if the words were not addressed to anyone.
Of course, I'd have the problem of maintaining a certain social position.
It's not my fault if I'll be embarrassed by a family name associated with a millionaire. I would need enough money for a year or two to establish myself in a manner suitable to my...
You won't get it from me.
I wasn't asking you for it, was I? Don't imagine that I couldn't get it somewhere else if I wanted to. Don't imagine that I couldn't leave. I'd go in a minute if I had only myself to think about. But Mother needs me. And if I deserted her...
Don't explain.
And besides, you misunderstood me, Henry. I haven't said anything to insult you. I wasn't speaking in any personal way. I was only discussing the general political picture from an abstract sociological viewpoint, which...
Don't explain, said Reardon. He was looking at Philip's face. It was half lowered, its eyes looking up at him. The eyes were lifeless, as if they had witnessed nothing. They held no spark of excitement, no personal sensation, neither of defiance nor of regret, neither of shame nor of suffering. They were filmy ovals that held no response to reality, no attempt to understand it, to weigh it, to reach some verdict of justice. Ovals that held nothing but a dull, still, mindless hatred. Don't explain. Just keep your mouth shut. The revulsion that made Reardon turn his face away contained a spasm of pity. There was an instant when he wanted to seize his brother's shoulders, to shake him, to cry, "How could you do this to yourself? How did you come to a stage where this is all that's left of you? Why did you let the wonderful fact of your own existence go by?" He looked away. He knew it was useless. He noted, in weary contempt, that the three at the table remained silent. Through all the years past, his consideration for them had brought him nothing but their maliciously righteous reproaches. Where was their righteousness now? Now was the time to stand on their code of justice, if justice had been any part of their code. Why didn't they throw at him all those accusations of cruelty and selfishness which he had come to accept as the eternal chorus to his life? What had permitted them to do it for years? He knew that the words he heard in his mind were the key to the answer. The sanction of the victim.
"Don't let's quarrel," said his mother, her voice cheerless and vague. "It's Thanksgiving Day."
When he looked at Lillian, he caught a glance that made him certain she had watched him for a long time. Its quality was panic. He got up. "You will please excuse me now," he said to the table at large.
"Where are you going?"
asked Lillian sharply. He stood looking at her for a deliberate moment, as if to confirm the meaning she would read in his answer. "To New York." She jumped to her feet.
"Tonight?"
"Now."
"You can't go to New York tonight."
Her voice was not loud, but it had the imperious helplessness of a shriek.
"This is not the time when you can afford it. When you can afford to desert your family, I mean. You ought to think about the matter of clean hands. You're not in a position to permit yourself anything which you know to be depravity."
By what code, thought Reardon? By what standard?
"Why do you wish to go to New York tonight?"
"I think, Lillian, for the same reason that makes you wish to stop me."
"Tomorrow is your trial."
"That is what I mean." He made a movement to turn, and she raised her voice.
"I don't want you to go."
He smiled. It was the first time he had smiled at her in the past 3 months. It was not the kind of smile she could care to see.
"I forbid you to leave us tonight."
He turned and left the room. Sitting at the wheel of his car, with the glassy, frozen road flying at his face and down under the wheels at 60 miles an hour, he let the thought of his family drop away from him,
and the vision of their faces went rolling back into the abyss of speed that swallowed the bare trees and lonely structures of the roadside. There was little traffic, and few lights in the distant clusters of the towns he passed. The emptiness of inactivity was the only sign of a holiday. A hazy glow, rusted by frost, flashed above the roof of a factory once in a rare while, and a cold wind shrieked through the joints of his car, beating the canvas top against the metal frame. By some dim sense of contrast which he did not define, the thought of his family was replaced by the thought of his encounter with the wet nurse, the Washington boy of his mills. At the time of his indictment, he had discovered that the boy had known about his deal with Daniger, yet had not reported it to anyone. "Why didn't you inform your friends about me?" he had asked. The boy had answered brusquely, not looking at him. "Didn't want to." "It was part of your job to watch precisely for things of that kind, wasn't it?"
"Yeah."
"Besides, your friends would have been delighted to hear it."
"I know."
"Didn't you know what a valuable piece of information it was? And what a stupendous trade you could have pulled with those friends of yours in Washington, whom you offered to me once, remember? The friends who always occasion expenses?" The boy had not answered. "It could have made your career at the very top level. Don't tell me that you didn't know it."
"I knew it."
"Then why didn't you make use of it?"
"I didn't want to."
"Why not?"
"Don't know."
The boy had stood, glumly avoiding Reardon's eyes, as if trying to avoid something incomprehensible within himself. Reardon had laughed. "Listen, non-absolute, you're playing with fire. Better go and murder somebody fast before you let it get you. That reason that stopped you from turning informer? Or else it will blast your career to hell." The boy had not answered. This morning Reardon had gone to his office as usual, even though the rest of the office building was closed. At lunchtime he had stopped at the rolling mills and had been astonished to find the wet nurse standing there, alone in a corner, ignored by everybody, watching the work with an air of childish enjoyment. "What are you doing here today?" Reardon had asked. "Don't you know it's a holiday?"
"Oh, I let the girls off, but I just came in to finish some business."
"What business?"
"Oh, letters and..." "Oh, hell. I signed 3 letters and sharpened my pencils. I know I didn't have to do it today, but I had nothing to do at home, and I get lonesome away from this place."
"Don't you have any family?"
"No. Not to speak of." "What about you, Mr. Reardon? Don't you have any?"
"I guess not to speak of."
"I like this place. I like to hang around. You know, Mr. Reardon, what I studied to be was a metallurgist."
Walking away, Reardon had turned to glance back and had caught the wet nurse looking after him, as a boy would look at the hero of his childhood's favorite adventure story. "God help the poor little bastard," he had thought. "God help them all," he thought, driving through the dark streets of a small town, borrowing, in contemptuous pity, the words of their belief which he had never shared. He saw newspapers displayed on metal stands, with the black letters of headlines screaming to empty corners, "Railroad Disaster." He had heard the news on the radio that afternoon. There had been a wreck on the main line of Taggart Transcontinental near Rockland, Wyoming. A split rail had sent a freight train crashing over the edge of a canyon. Wrecks on the Taggart main line were becoming more frequent. The track was wearing out. The track which, less than 18 months ago, Dagny was planning to rebuild, promising him a journey from coast to coast on his own mettle. She had spent a year picking worn rail from abandoned branches to patch the rail of the main line.
She had spent months fighting the men of Jim's board of directors, who said that the national emergency was only temporary and a track that had lasted for 10 years could well last for another winter, until spring, when conditions would improve, as Mr. Wesley Mouch had promised. 3 weeks ago she had made them authorize the purchase of 60,000 tons of new rail. It could do no more than make a few patches across the continent in the worst divisions, but it was all she had been able to obtain from them. She had had to wrench the money out of men deaf with panic. The freight revenues were falling at such a rate that the men of the board had begun to tremble, staring at Jim's idea of the most prosperous year in Taggart history. She had had to order steel rail. There was no hope of obtaining an emergency need permission to buy Reardon metal, and no time to beg for it. Reardon looked away from the headlines to the glow at the edge of the sky, which was the city of New York far ahead. His hands tightened on the wheel a little. It was 9:30 when he reached the city. Dagny's apartment was dark when he let himself in with his key. He picked up the telephone and called her office. Her own voice answered, "Taggart Transcontinental." "Don't you know it's a holiday?" he asked. "Hello, Hank. Railroads have no holidays. Where are you calling from?" "Your place." "I'll be through in another 30 minutes. "It's all right. Stay there. I'll come for you." The anteroom of her office was dark when he entered, except for the lighted glass cubbyhole of Eddie Willers. Eddie was closing his desk, getting ready to leave. He looked at Reardon in puzzled astonishment. "Good evening, Eddie. What is it that keeps you people so busy?" "The Rockland wreck." Eddie sighed.
"Yes, Mr. Reardon."
"That's what I want to see Dagny about. About your rail."
"She's still here."
He started toward her door when Eddie called after him hesitantly, "Mr. Reardon..." He stopped. "Yes?"
"I wanted to say, because tomorrow is your trial, and whatever they do to you is supposed to be in the name of all the people, I just wanted to say that it won't be in my name, even if there's nothing I can do about it, except to tell you, even if I know that that doesn't mean anything."
"It means much more than you suspect. Perhaps more than any of us suspect. Thanks, Eddie." Dagny glanced up from her desk when Reardon entered her office. He saw her watching him as he approached, and he saw the look of weariness disappearing from her eyes. He sat down on the edge of the desk. She leaned back, brushing a strand of hair off her face, her shoulders relaxing under her thin white blouse. "Dagny, there's something I want to tell you about the rail that you ordered. I want you to know this tonight." She was watching him attentively. The expression of his face pulled hers into the same look of quietly solemn tension. "I am supposed to deliver to Taggart Transcontinental on February 15th 60,000 tons of rail, which is to give you 300 miles of track. You will receive, for the same sum of money, 80,000 tons of rail, which will give you 500 miles of track. You know what material is cheaper and lighter than steel. Your rail will not be steel. It will be reared in metal. Don't argue, object, or agree. I am not asking for your consent. You are not supposed to consent or to know anything about it. I am doing this, and I alone will be responsible. We will work it so that those on your staff who will know that you've ordered steel won't know that you've received Reardon metal, and those who will know that you've received Reardon metal won't know that you had no permit to buy it. We will tangle the bookkeeping in such a way that if the thing should ever blow up, nobody will be able to pin anything on anybody, except on me. They might suspect that I bribed someone on your staff, or they might suspect that you were in on it, but they won't be able to prove it. I want you to give me your word that you will never admit it, no matter what happens. It's my metal.
and if there are any chances to take, it's I who will take them. I've been planning this from the day I received your order. I have ordered the copper for it from a source which will not betray me. I did not intend to tell you about it till later, but I changed my mind. I want you to know it tonight, because I am going on trial tomorrow for the same kind of crime. She had listened without moving. At his last sentence, he saw a faint contraction of her cheeks and lips. It was not quite a smile, but it gave him her whole answer. Pain, admiration, understanding. Then he saw her eyes becoming softer, more painfully, dangerously alive. He took her wrist, as if the tight grasp of his fingers and the severity of his glance were to give her the support she needed, and he said sternly, "Don't thank me. This is not a favor. I am doing it in order to be able to bear my work, or else I'll break like Ken Daniger." She whispered, "All right, Hank. I won't thank you," the tone of her voice and the look of her eyes making it a lie by the time it was uttered. He smiled. "Give me the word."